On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Today, on The Lines Between Us, our weekly examination of inequality in the Baltimore region, we're continuing our look at employment opportunities. When a developer proposes major changes to a Baltimore neighborhood, a chorus of criticism often arises, usually from local shops who don't want to be put out of business and historic preservationists who want to save significant buildings. One of the strongest arguments a developer can counter with is this: we've got jobs. Last week, Maryland's highest court cleared the path for an out-of-state developer to build a Walmart in the middle of Baltimore City. In recent years, the developers for that and other big projects have promised to make hundreds of local hires. In today's installment of The Lines Between Us, we ask, do developers have a good track record of creating work for the neighborhoods they change? Reporter Melody Simmons investigates.
On Baltimore's east side, workers are busy constructing a $170 million lab for the Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. It's in the 88-acre footprint of East Baltimore Development, Inc., a $1.8 billion redevelopment near Johns Hopkins Hospital. Critics of the project say Philadelphia-based Turner Construction Company has hired too few local workers for the project. The lab's owner, the Maryland Economic Development Corp, or MEDCO, is monitoring the hiring. Their goal is to employ 100 local residents. So far, out of the 293 workers, 76 have been from East Baltimore. Josh Neiman is Assistant Director for Development at MEDCO.
We have a large number of checks and balances to make sure that our goals are being met.
First, they approach residents, or former residents, of the 88-acre EBDI footprint. Then they look at 11 specific Baltimore zip codes. Then they search citywide. Some are hired from a workforce pipeline created by EBDI officials. No one at EBDI accepted our request to be interviewed for this story. The EBDI project, which has more than $212 million in public funds invested, has stated goals to identify, train, and hire a new workforce.
Construction is a series of short-term jobs. So if you can give somebody a skill set and they have sustainable skills that they're then moving from one to the next, that's why it's important.
Development projects like this are peppered throughout the city, each one spurring dreams of steady employment among residents of nearby low-income neighborhoods. On the west side of downtown, for instance, Lexington Square Partners is redeveloping the so-called Superblock. When developers do follow through on local hiring promises, they usually look to the Mayor's Office of Employment Development for help. Director Karen Sitnick said the office operates three career centers that can help them find workers. MOED doesn't track local hiring rates for big developments. It does have local hiring numbers for outside businesses who contract with the city. Here's some data from August 2011 through October 2012. Businesses with contracts of at least $50,000 hired a collective workforce of more than 3,000 people. 40% of those workers, about 1,200, were city residents. MOED's data doesn't distinguish between temporary construction jobs and more permanent work. Karen Sitnick says that although MOED doesn't hold developers accountable for making a particular number of local hires, she does believe it's in developers' own interest to bring on locals.
Every developer that we've ever met with recognizes the value in hiring local. And while there may not be specific numerical goals, the intent, and this is proven always, the intent is if you can hire people who live around where the development is, the likelihood is that they're going to be strong workers.
The planned 25th Street Station project will include a Walmart and other new retail on 11 acres in Remington. It has been stalled for years because of the recession and a zoning dispute, although the dispute was resolved in the developer's favor just last week by the Maryland Court of Appeals. Despite the slow progress, the out-of-state developer, WV Urban Developments LLC, sponsored a job fair in January 2011. Partnering with the Mayor's Office of Employment Development, they identified job seekers from nearby neighborhoods who were then allowed to arrive earlier than everyone else. Even though groundbreaking was a long way off, locals desperate for a paycheck came to the job expo, hoping to be hired by the developer. You can hear the frustration in the voice of one job seeker who declined to give her name.
I've been following this story. I was actually opposed to this development, but now that it's happening and I find myself in a position of needing a job, I don't want to stop.
Caroline Paff is the project manager for the 25th Street Station developer. She says they signed an agreement with local community associations that she thinks will be attractive to potential tenants of the project.
And in that letter, what we've done is pay the cost of the recruitment coordinator through MOED. The community associations also will be making direct referrals, both to the project and to MOED. MOED will be making the referrals back to our retailers.
A similar job recruiter will be funded by Caesars Entertainment for the city's new Horseshoe Casino. Whiting Turner Contracting will bring 900 workers to the city to build the casino off of Russell Street. Karen Sitnick of the Mayor's Office of Employment Development says a total of 1,700 jobs inside the casino are expected to open up in the next year and a half.
Jobs that'll be right on the casino floor, those that'll be working with the slots as well as the table games, and there'll be employment opportunities in restaurants and in shops. There'll be grounds and security. It's be a variety of employment opportunities.
At a city council hearing earlier this month, a committee heard testimony about local hiring at the $400 million casino. George Fields showed up seeking answers. Trained in multiple specialties for construction work, Fields is an ex-offender and has found it nearly impossible to find work in his trade.
It's not even a thought that crosses their mind. What we've been hearing is we're not dependable, and that is humiliating for us to hear that.
Fields says he's been out of work for more than 6 years. The toll has been heavy on his family. Fields says he has 4 kids and his wife works 2 jobs.
I don't want to hurt anyone. And there are a lot of us who don't want to hurt people. We don't want to hurt anyone. We don't want to go out and rob. But when you force me into a situation where I need to take care of my family and I need to support my wife who's breaking her back, what do I do? Who do I go to? Because every door is being slammed in my face. And this is heartbreaking to me, where I'm sitting in the bathroom crying because I don't want my kids to see me crying, but I'm crying because I don't know what else to do.
I watched Fields walk into the ornate council chamber. City development officials and Caesars executives were pledging, as many developers have before, to hire local workers. Time will tell if George Fields' aspirations will bear fruit. Groundbreaking on the casino is expected in the spring. I'm Melody Simmons, reporting in Baltimore.
On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. This is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast in the studio with reporter Melody Simmons. Melody, you gave us some of the specific results of particular developments, but I want to get your conclusions. Overall, what's your sense of how effective new development is in the city, in hiring city residents?
I think that the intent is good. I don't think that the figures bear out all of the promises that are made. I think that we're seeing a movement toward more solidifying this a little bit more. There's some movement in City Hall to force certain quotas. I don't know legally if that's going to happen, but it is now part of a big conversation.
Well, what is it that holds, if the intentions are good, what is it that holds back hiring city residents as workers?
I think that a lot of the developers come in and the contractors come in and they have a workforce in place. So with that workforce, they just get the job going. As far as hiring and training other people that are local workers, it just takes extra time. And that seems to me what's happened here is that a lot of this has slowed, is viewed to be as something that slows down the process. So they want to move ahead because they're on a time schedule. And with that time schedule, they just bring their workers in.
And we're talking here about the construction force that builds a development, or also the jobs the permanent jobs that are placed in that development?
It's a mix. A lot of the developments are still underway, so the hiring hasn't started yet for the permanent jobs. Mostly we're talking about the construction jobs here.
And which is the bigger pool? Are there more jobs involved in construction, or will there be more jobs week after week once the developments are functioning?
I think once they're functioning, you're going to have more permanent jobs. Right now with the construction jobs, there is kind of a rolling merry-go-round because these jobs are short-term. Some people are on the job for weeks or months, and then the job ends. So you have a kind of a rolling job site going on.
And when city officials press developers for local hire, do they press for local work crews in construction, or have they sort of given up and assume that developers are going to bring in crews from the outside?
They're just starting to press on that. We've seen that with the Superblock project and some of the commitments that have been made by the Dawson Company out of Atlanta and Lexington Square Partners to hire locally. So there is a whole new breath of hope that this might take place for some of the local workers who are seeking jobs.
Do you have any sense of whether any other cities have figured out a better way to do it?
I don't have a sense of that. I think that it is a conversation that goes on all the time with these developments. I think because there is a deadline and there's time constraints, that a lot of these things are on the horizon, but they really are not adhered to. Legally, in Maryland, you can't impose a quota.
Mm-hmm.
So that's caused problem. And Jack Young is trying to propose legislation in City Hall for such
numbers.
The City
Council President.
Yes. And so they're trying to do that. But the city solicitor, George Nilsen, has said that that's not constitutional. So there is a battle going on right now.
Melody, thanks for your reporting. Thanks.
Thank you, Sheila.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Mornings, The Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
To get a closer look at local hiring on big developments in Baltimore, we're going to drill down on one in particular, the so-called Superblock. This is the block bounded by Lexington, Fayette, Howard, and Park Streets on the west side of downtown. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake says a developer called Lexington Square Partners will create 500,000 square feet of retail, parking, and apartments. And joining us now is Baltimore City 12th District Councilman Carl Stokes. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, great to be here. Hi, Sheila. How are you today?
Just fine. How are you?
Good, good.
And also here is Reverend Todd Yeary, senior pastor of Douglas Memorial Community Church in Baltimore. He's part of an alliance of ministers that negotiated a local hiring deal with Lexington Square Partners. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Sheila. Good to be here.
And joining us by phone from Atlanta is Bailey Pope, senior vice president for design and construction at the Dawson Company, the development manager for Lexington Square Partners. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Sheila. Thank you for having me.
Now, Bailey Pope, what is the agreement as far as local hiring? I mean, is there a specific number of hires that's been agreed on?
Well, we have established an economic inclusion plan for the Lexington Square project that encompasses both inclusion of minority and women-owned businesses and hiring of Baltimore City residents.
And what does it call for?
Ideally, 20% of all of the workers involved in the project will be Baltimore City residents. And of that, we anticipate that 50% of all newly hired workers will be Baltimore City residents.
Reverend Yeary, Mayor Rawlings-Blake says the development will create 600 construction jobs right off the bat and then generate 750 permanent jobs once it's built. Baltimore Brew reported that a 2010 report sent by Lexington Square Partners to the Baltimore Development Corporation put it at more like 325 permanent jobs, like half as many.
Yeah, a lot of that depends on the type of retailers and extent of retail operations that we're able to attract.
Yeah.
That's an ongoing process.
I think the question speaks to why
I really
this
want
to
what,
be such
what
a,
you're
such,
expecting
such,
to
such,
happen.
Here's what I'm expecting to happen. Whether it's 325, whether it's 600, whatever that number is, There should be a committed and engaged effort to hire as many local residents as is absolutely possible, which requires several things to happen all at once. One, to identify those who are already trained, qualified, ready to go into the pipeline, and to identify where there are some training opportunities and needs. Because as your series is discussing these structural impediments, one of the structural impediments that we found in talking about the notions of economic inclusion is many times we've not begun to do the preliminary work to get folks who want to work connected with the soft skills and the specific skill sets that are necessary to get them ready. So what will happen is you will have a development project to come online. It's ready to put shovels in the ground, but you've done none of the preliminary work to get anybody ready to go. And so then the developer's left wondering, all right, what am I to do?
This project is getting a pilot, a payment in lieu of taxes benefit. The Baltimore Sun says the deal is worth about $22 million in tax break. Is the tax break dependent on this local hiring?
It's not dependent. We've asked for a good faith effort. In other words, we didn't make it a part of the law. We felt that the pastors, the community churches working with the developer were working in good faith. And there is an MOU. There's a signed agreement between the pastors and the developer that I wouldn't say has the force of law, but it certainly is something that we expect both parties to hold to.
That's City Councilman Carl Stokes here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about developers making promises for local hiring. Also with us is Reverend Todd Urey, Senior Pastor of Douglas Memorial Community Church in Baltimore, and Bailey Pope, Senior Vice President of the Dawson Company, part of the team developing the super block. I'm at a disadvantage. I have not seen this memorandum of understanding. Is it public?
It is public.
Can you tell me briefly how we in the public can hold you accountable, Bailey Pope? I mean, how do we know whether this is happening?
In the economic inclusion plan, it expresses the objective of establishing an advisory committee, which is going to be members of the partners that signed it. And so as a developer, we're going to be collecting from all of our contractors and subcontractors monthly reports. That's a requirement in order for them to get paid. They have to submit paperwork to us that, you know, that just sort of tracks their experience with hiring. We'll be compiling that and submitting quarterly reports to the advisory committee, as well as to the two city agencies.
And those reports will be public?
I suppose they could be.
Well, as the councilman, as chairman of Taxation, Finance, Economic Development, they will be public. We will expect everyone will be watching each other. But also, and I say it with a smile on my face, we will be having hearings now and again throughout the course of the project.
Councilman Stokes, in 2011, as chair of the Finance Committee, you threatened a moratorium on tax breaks like this one for Lexington Square Partners, saying the city needed first to act on a list of recommendations from a task force you had convened. And one of those recommendations was, quote, carefully and continually measure the economic results and social returns to the community that are promised by developers and limit the time for developers to begin to work. Does this deal meet that standard?
Yes, it does. It actually met three of the recommendations. As the deal came before us, it did not have inclusionary housing as a part of the project. The developer, to his credit, took this on and allowed a certain number of the units to be affordable. And so we have that. Then we have the matter of the local hires as a part of it. And finally, one of the strong recommendations of that task force was that there be a local profit sharing, so that if the developer were to sell the project or to make an unusual amount of profit, that there would be a return to the city taxpayers for their investment.
I want to bring up the experience of another city, New York City. Developers who built a Costco and a Best Buy in East Harlem had an agreement with the community board to hire 6 out of 10 workers locally, but they reached only about 4 out of 10. And part of the reasons they cited for falling short was that many applicants failed drug tests or had criminal records. And we've heard this so often in Baltimore. How will Lexington Square Partners handle a candidate with the right skills and motivation but a criminal record or a failed drug test?
Bailey?
You know, we are seeking qualified workers. They need to meet the requirements of the contractor that's hiring them. So we are not in a position to make special exceptions. However, the process that we're setting up is the one of the objectives of that is to the greatest extent possible, help people to become job ready.
But I think, Sheila, we have to be, when you mention that, number one, we expect and we have an obligation as part of the community partner to make sure that those that are coming into the process understand you have obligations to be ready, willing, able to go to work. So if you've got drug issue challenges, we need to get you in treatment. We got to get you clean because a dirty drop, quote unquote, a tainted urine sample is not going to allow you to take on the significance of working on a major construction project under any circumstances. We're not saying that there's any automatic disqualifier except something that's real obvious. This is, you know, a dirty drop, that's an automatic disqualifier, really. If you come in and you can't show up to work on time, if the job starts at 8 and you show up at 8:10, that's a problem. The developer cannot be held responsible for the failure of folks not to do just simple things that we assume ought to be part of that process. So we're working with folks in the pipeline with soft skills, show up on time. Do you have prior issues that we need to work through? Let's talk about them, get them on the table. Do you have transportation concerns? Are there issues around childcare that would preclude you? That's where the community's role is. That's not the developer's role, but that's our role in the process.
What Pastor is saying is that we have enough time prior to the start of construction to get people ready. Most of the people who will come looking for a job will be ready to go or close to ready to go. But those who are not, and those who have challenges, whether it's a drug or alcohol or prior convictions, there's enough time working with the pastors and the community, Associated Black Charities and others, to get people ready over a 6 to 12 month period.
But when it comes to criminal records?
Well, when you say criminal records, that's sort of a broad, very broad field to lay. I don't know what this particular job is going to do, but in most cases, those are handled on a case-by-case basis.
Right. Reverend Urie, the legislative note from the Department of Planning mentions the estimated average salary of these new jobs being created at a little less than $21,000 a year. What kind of average salary do you think is a good wage to work on this project in Baltimore?
Again, we do broad questioning. You've got jobs that range from laborers to specialized skills, and I think it really depends on where you fall within that skill set that would determine what your wage should be. Certainly what we want is, and I think, Bailey, we didn't mention this point, this EIP specifically,
EIP.
Economic Inclusion Plan, this plan focuses on and prioritizes the most vulnerable amongst us, persons who are already receiving public assistance. So if they're getting temporary cash assistance, if they are in foster care, aging out of foster care, if there are persons that have other court-ordered obligations that but for employment, they're not going to be able to make, say, child support. You're under court-ordered child support, but you can't find employment. Those are the kind of the first source priorities that we're looking at, even within the local hiring commitment. So we want to take kind of the working poor and begin to get them into a process that they can then grow into a career. So there may be some folks that start in the $21,000 range, but with the building of experience and then over time, as these other opportunities come up, I think there'll be room for growth and expansion.
Bailey Pope, when do these jobs start showing up?
We're anticipating that, from some of the technical jobs, the design and construction work, which is also covered, or the design work, which is also covered by the EIP, is going to be starting in the next couple of months, where we've got architects and engineers and working through everything. We will probably be starting some of the initial labor work with cleaning up some of the old buildings this summer, and then anticipate starting serious construction in the fall.
We have to leave it there. I really appreciate you all talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Bailey.
Carl Stokes represents the 12th District in Baltimore City Council. Reverend Todd Yeary is senior pastor at Douglas Memorial Community Church in Baltimore. And Bailey Pope is senior vice president for design and construction at the Dawson Company in Atlanta. Online, we have more about development and local hiring, as well as a map that shows where jobs are concentrated in the Baltimore region. Go to linesbetweenus.org. On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on The Lines Between Us, Katie Alston of Marion House on women's struggles to overcome addiction, violence, poverty, and mental illness. Stay with us.
Thanks for downloading this week's episode of The Lines Between Us, a weekly series on 88.1 WYPR about inequality in the Baltimore region. I'm Lawrence Lanahan, senior producer for Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Much more on our website, including data maps, opportunities for listeners to join the discussion, and more stories like the one you're about to hear. That's linesbetweenus.org. Now, back to the podcast. Welcome back to The Lines Between Us. I'm Tom Hall. For the past 30 years, Marion House in Baltimore has been offering services to women who are homeless, unemployed, and sometimes suffering from addiction. They've often suffered trauma and abuse. They and their children come to Marion House at the absolute nadir of their lives. And when they get there, they find a safe environment where they can develop the skills that make it possible for them to lead full, independent lives. To celebrate their 30th anniversary, they've organized a traveling exhibition that highlights the stories of 30 alumna of Marion House. It's currently at Gibbons Hall on the campus of Notre Dame of Maryland University, and later this month it will move to the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. In April, it'll be on display at the Pratt Library on Cathedral Street. There's an accompanying book with the same title as the exhibit. It's called 30 Women, 30 Stories. Katie Alston has been the executive director of Marion House since 2007, and she joins me in the studio. Good morning, Katie. It's good to see you.
Good morning, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So the book is divided into five sections. Tell us what those sections are, and I'm assuming that these are issues that many, if not all, of your clients confront.
Yes, the five chapters are surrounded by these issues: homelessness, incarceration, mental illness, trauma, and addiction are our topics in each of the five chapters. And in every case, the woman has that issue. Although I must say, some of the women could have been in any chapter.
And you're also having a series of panels. The one you have coming up next week, it's on Thursday at Notre Dame, is an interesting exemplar because it's about the relationship between addiction and mental illness, for example.
Yes.
Because what's really fascinating about this is that you go to the website and you can hear an audio version of each one of the women who are featured in the book. This is a woman named Audrey Fisher, and let's hear what Audrey Fisher has to say.
My relationship with my daughter as she was growing up was distant. Even though I was there, I wasn't there. I always thought if I gave her enough things, she would be fine. So pretty much growing up, that's all she got from me was things. Things that occupy her while mommy was off doing what she was doing. But now it makes me very happy to know that she can rely on me today. My mother tells me that she always knew that I would straighten up eventually. So she was always there throughout my whole addiction. My mother would tell me every day that I was out on the streets using drugs, that she would watch the news every night, praying that she didn't see me on there, either dead or on the most wanted list. And I'm just truly grateful that she never had to see that, that I lived through it, because some people don't.
Audrey Fisher, one of the alumnae of Marion House, in a testimonial that is part of the book, 30 Women, 30 Stories. So Katie Alston, they write in the book, in the preface to the section on addiction, which Ms. Fisher has struggled with, and as you mentioned, so many of the clients you work with struggle with it, that it used to be that cancer and depression had a taboo, a stigma associated with them, and now addiction still does. So I guess that's a real challenge, is to get people over that the stigma of addiction.
Yes, asking for help is a huge part of the struggle. And in some cases, it's because it's the only life the women have known, and they don't even know how to function I mean, truly, not just physically, but in terms of their lifestyle, the people that they know, the neighborhood they're in, the everyone that they surround themselves with is usually part of the disease and a part of the plague that is upon our city, unfortunately. So they have to get out of that.
As we mentioned, the panel that you have is going to talk next Thursday is going to talk about the confluence often of mental illness and substance abuse. So people who are struggling with addiction often struggle with mental illness. Is this the case with a lot of the folks that you work with?
Yes, definitely. We actually, over half of the women that we see in the Marion House Transitional Program have mental illness diagnosed. And they also, all of them in the transitional program have chemical addictions. Most of our women have some need that they're medicating through their addiction. Often when they first start using the drugs and the alcohol, it is because they're dealing with some sort of trauma, some sort of experience, some sort of depression, some sort of maybe neglect when they're young and their families. And again, unfortunately, over the course of the years that we've been running the program, what was, say, 30 years ago, a woman would come to us and she'd have maybe a good family, you know, that was very involved and really caring for her. Now we find that many of our women are learning about the drugs and the alcohol from their own parents. So it's a multi-generational problem.
Let's hear from another one of the alums from Marion House. This is Nalisha Gibbs. She'll actually be part of the panel next Thursday. She has struggled with mental illness. Let's hear a little bit from Ms. Gibbs.
I got my GED. I worked hard for that piece of paper. 5 years ago, I would not have thought about getting my GED. I would not have thought about getting my phlebotomy certification or attending college. But to get that GED and walking on the campus of Coppin State University for my first year, mind blowing. And I know that if I can achieve that, I am bound to achieve anything in life. And I never forget seeing the look in my mom's eyes. I was the first one in the family to ever complete high school.
Nalisha Gibbs, she's one of the 30 women who are profiled in the book 30 Women, 30 Stories, produced for the 30th anniversary of Marion House. Katie Alston is the executive director of Marion House. She joins me in the studio. You're listening to The Lines Between Us on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. So both these testimonials from Ms. Fisher and Ms. Gibbs, you know, emotionally charged, and they both are exemplars of people who have taken great individual responsibility for their lives. I mean, they're stepping up. That's a big parameter of this. And there are a lot of folks who are opposed to programs like yours, who don't think that the state or even nonprofits should be offering services like this, because they simply see it as a black and white issue of, you know, no individual responsibility, forget it. Do you encounter that a lot?
Yes. And many people believe that you should just be able to stop using drugs. It's just a choice that these people, you know, in our case, our women have made. And I just believe that if they had a chance to sit down, as I hope this book gives them an opportunity to, and the website, but if they sit down and actually get to know one of these women and understand what they've lived through, they'd understand that if it had happened to them, and this is what I always say, if I had lived these lives, I would be a drug addict also. I have absolutely no doubt about it. I would have suffered through depression. And you said something wonderful there, personal responsibility. The women are choosing to come to us. They are saying, I want to get out of this.
How many women are you able to treat at one time or to offer housing to at one time?
Well, our transitional program for single women has 48 beds. We also have a small transitional program for families of 4 apartments, and then we have permanent supportive housing. So women are potentially able to go through the rehabilitative process in the transitional program and then get a subsidized apartment. The goal of our program is that the women become employed. But unfortunately, Baltimore is not the affordable city that it used to be. And so even working a full-time job, if they're working at McDonald's or working at a job where they're only getting $10 an hour, they actually can't afford to get their own apartment in this city anymore. So we're able to use some grant dollars that we have to subsidize permanent housing for the women, which is really helpful.
So one of the sections in the book has to do with incarceration.
Yes.
A lot of folks are getting out of prison. A few of these testimonials are, you know, I've come out,
I can't get a job. No one will hire me. They say they'll hire me, but they won't. What kind of advice do you give a woman in that position?
We spend a lot of time working with the women on that issue. They actually go through an employment readiness program at Marion House, and we have a dedicated staff person, our employment coordinator. And we work really hard as an organization to develop relationships with employers who understand what we're doing at Marion House and then ideally are willing to take a chance on one of our women. You know, the thing that I find interesting is that truly the women know that they have something to prove. I think our women understanding that they potentially haven't worked in a period of time, they don't have, you know, a wonderfully long resume, they have this criminal background they need to overcome, they're more motivated, I think, because they understand that they have something to prove. But we have heartache after heartache, to be honest, about this issue. Just before I came here today, I was talking to one of our current residents who, you know, had this great interview with an organization. They loved her. I put in a good word for her. And the conviction that they saw is 10 years old.
But to break that cycle, then, you're finding that if a woman is affiliated with Marion House, that helps, that the employers say, okay, well, she's getting help, she's got a support system, they're less reticent to take a chance on her?
If we've managed to convince them, yes, that's the goal. We spend a lot of time bringing people into the organization, walking them around, talking to them, letting them meet some of the women so that they get a sense of what we're trying to do. Now, of course, the women aren't barricaded into Marion House, so we can't promise that an employer might not hire a woman and then she's going to decide to move out on her own and leave the program. But we are there should there be any concerns, as long as she stays in the program. It isn't just about getting the job. It's about keeping the job. It's about having the skills to handle interpersonal relationships on the job and conflict and transportation, understanding the importance of calling when you're going to be late or sick. I mean, and all those things are things that we work on with our women.
Is there one thing, one big challenge that you find is overarching and, you know, is a dimension of each of these women's situations? What's the biggest issue you face?
These women are broken. It's sad. It's an understatement. They've gone through so much that to build them back up again is very difficult, and it takes a very long time. And that's why we need them to come and live with us and be amongst us for so long. I mean, up to 2 years. They don't know what it's like to have someone to just say, "Good morning, Tom. How are you doing today?" Like, they are not used to some of the most basic elements of being treated like a human being when they first come to us in many cases. So there's a lot of work that we have to do.
Yeah, and you're not trying to flip a switch, and it's not like some rehab program even that's, you know, 25 days in rehab and
exactly,
then you're done. And, you know, I mean, this is, as this book proves, you've got a lot of alums who are coming back and staying in touch and making sure that they stay connected.
Yes. We've actually formalized an alumni association in the past year or so. A big piece of this is not only for the general public to just understand the issues. Certainly that's something we want to accomplish. We want other men and women who are struggling with these issues out there in our city, in our community, to see that there is hope for them too. These 30 women got better. And of course, they're just a sampling of women who got better. And I want the women and men suffering to know that. And I want those of us who think that the bum on the street is just a bum on the street to know that, no, he's a human being and he's got a story. There's a reason he's there. And with the right help, he can get better.
Katie Alston is the executive director of Marion House in Baltimore. The traveling exhibition, 30 Women, 30 Stories, is at Gibbons Hall on the campus of Notre Dame of Maryland University. The next community dialogue will be held at Notre Dame Thursday night, 5:30 in Knott Auditorium. The panel will include Marion House alumnae Nalisha Gibbs, as well as experts in the field of mental health and substance abuse. Come to our website, WIPR.org, to hear more stories from other alums of Marion House. We'll also have links to more information about the panel, the book, and the DVD. Katie, thank you so much. The work you're doing is terrific. I've been over to Marion House, as you know, and it's impressive and inspiring. So thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Monday morning, we'll savor the Ravens' nearly certain victory in the Super Bowl, and we'll talk Shakespeare with the director of the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company, and theater critic J. Wynn Russick will weigh in with her review of The Mountaintop at Center Stage. I hope you can join us Monday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, go Ravens. I'm Tom Hall. Enjoy the game.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.